Number 10, Shamanaya Didi Bhagavad Gita continued.
My most worshipable Diksha Gurudev, Nitya Leela Pravishta Om Vishnu Pad, Astodhira Satshi Shimachila Bhakti Vedanta Swami Prabhupada, and the same unlimited obeisances in the dust of the lotus feet of my most worshipable Shiksha Gurudev. Om Vishnu Pad, Astodhira Satshi Shimachila Bhakti Vedanta Narayan Gosai Maharaj, to all of our Guru Varga and all the assembled devotees. So today will be the last day of our extended Gita Jayanti. Although I'd love to go on.
We might go on. We're only in chapter 4.
Huh? What? Too loud?
No. I said I think it might go on till tomorrow because we're only on chapter 4.
Well, it's up to you all. Whether you want to continue with Bhagavad Gita or you want to continue with Jivadharma. I'm just the servant of the servant of the servant. What would you all like to do? Or should we wait till more of the classes here and ask them? Ask everybody. What they would, because for me, I could go all the way.
I wonder how many days it would take for us to finish the Bhagavad Gita.
At the rate we're going, it would take 4 or 5 days. Does anybody have any opinions at the moment? Okay, take a vote. Either way, what do you say, Anupama? Either way. Okay, then it's a kind of unanimous that it's okay to do Bhagavad Gita. So we'll see what happens when other people come, if they do. And if they don't, then we'll just go with our vote. Now Krishna is going to tell how he invented the Varnashram system. According to the three modes, this is text 13 of chapter 4. What's your vote, Krishna Bhakti? Should we continue with Bhagavad Gita starting tomorrow or continue with Jivadharma? According to the three modes of material nature and the work ascribed to them, the four divisions of human society were created by me. And although I'm the creator of this system, you should know that I'm yet the non-doer, being unchangeable. My God, what does that mean? What does it mean? It means he doesn't belong to any of the divisions. He's now one of the conditioned souls. He's the creator of everything, and everything is born of him. Everything is sustained by him. After annihilation, everything rests in him. So in that way, he's the creator of the four divisions. But at the same time, he's not any one of them. That's what it means. He creates everything, so why not that? In addition. Because these divisions are there in the spiritual world too. So naturally they have to be here in their reverse reflection. Because everything has a reflection. There's no work that affects me. He's continuing to explain what he means that he's the non-doer being unchangeable. There's no work that affects me, nor do I aspire for the fruits of action. He told Arjuna a few verses ago, don't think that you're the doer. Don't think that you're the cause of the result of the activity. Don't think that you're the cause of the activity. One who understands this truth about me, his inconceivable nature, that although he creates the four divisions of society, eight divisions actually, He's the non-doer being unchangeable. No work affects him, and he doesn't aspire for the fruits of action. Nor does he become entangled in the fruit of reaction of work. All liberated souls in ancient times acted with this understanding about himself and what they're supposed to be, and so they attained liberation. Therefore, as did the ancients, Mahajana Janagatapata Sapanta, follow the path that's been prescribed by the previous acharyas. Therefore, as did the ancients, you should do your duty in this divine consciousness, just like me. Like he said, if I didn't work, then all the world would go to hell by following my example. So work without attachment, just like I do. I have no desire for the fruits of work. So the ancients follow me, and if you follow the ancients, you'll be liberated. Even the intelligent are bewildered in determining what is action and what is inaction. Krishna said, I created it, but I'm not the doer. So what's action and what's inaction? Even the intelligent are bewildered. So now I shall explain to you what action is, knowing which you shall be liberated from all sins. The intricacies of action and inaction are very difficult to understand. Therefore, one should know properly what is action, what is forbidden action, and what is inaction. Now comes an even bigger tongue twister. One who sees inaction in action and action in inaction is intelligent among men, and he is in the transcendental position, although engaged in all sorts of activities. In other words, one who sees devotional service in action, that it's not fruitive, although it looks like fruitive activity, it's not, it's devotional service. So it's inaction. And one who sees inaction in action. That is, this looks like work, but it's not fruitive work. And one who sees action in inaction, even if somebody doesn't do work, they still have to get karma if they're on the material platform. That's why Krishna told Arjuna, it's not by mere renunciation alone that you can achieve freedom from reaction, just by not doing your duty. Just by sitting there, you're breathing, you're getting sinful reactions. One is understood to be in full knowledge, whose every action is devoid of a desire for sense gratification. That is a person in knowledge. So if you say, oh, he's stupid, he's intelligent, but this is the real criteria. Other things are just basically skills. He is said by sages to be a worker whose fruitive activities are burnt up in the fire of perfect knowledge. Therefore, Arjuna, abandoning all attachment to the results of your activities, just like sometimes we pretend to others and even to ourselves that I'm concerned about Krishna. Like, what would be an example? I worked so hard, say I went to sell my posters at an art show. I worked so hard and then nobody came. And the people who came didn't like my artwork. So, wow, they're so offensive to Krishna, and you know, Krishna didn't get any money for his Navadvipa temple, and I can go on at infinitum how it's a Krishna service, but what I'm really thinking of is I wasted all my time, I could have been doing something else. So it's very high to really be, to work for the satisfaction of Krishna, and to be detached from the desire to enjoy the fruits of it. Abandoning all attachment to the fruits of his activities, ever satisfied and independent. That would be a litmus test. If he's actually abandoned the attachment to the results of his activities, if he's satisfied and independent. He performs no fruitive action although engaged in all kinds of undertakings. One who is satisfied, here's another test. One who is satisfied with gain which comes of its own accord, who is free from duality and does not envy, who is steady in success or failure, is never entangled, although performing actions. So what are the tests? He's satisfied with gain which comes of its own accord. He's free from duality and does not envy. These are high things. Who is steady both in success and failure, and is never entangled, although performing actions, is never entangled. And he's talking about sacrifice, different kinds of sacrifices. Without sacrifice, one can never be happy in this planet or in this life, and what to speak of the next. Sacrificing my own will, my own ambition, desires for Krishna's satisfaction. When you have learned the truth, what will you know? You'll know that all living beings are but part of me. Oh wait, we didn't do the guru one. Now this is the famous 434. Does anybody know what that is? Tadvidi pranipatena pariprasena sevaya upadakshanti te jnanam jnaninas tatvadarsana. Just try to learn the truth by approaching a spiritual master. Inquire of him submissively and render service unto him. He will impart knowledge unto you because he has seen the truth. And when you have thus learned the truth, what will you know? That all living beings are but part of me. They're in me and they are mine. Are they yours, Vasanti? Are they yours, Raghavata? Are they yours, Vasanti? No, they're Krishna's, and they're in him. We try to make people come in us sometimes, like, that lousy, good-for-nothing. And then I'm bringing them into myself. But I'm not really bringing them into myself, I'm just bringing my conception of them in. And then, yeah, I'll really make them suffer by thinking all these terrible things about them. Who am I making suffer? Me. They're off enjoying somewhere. Right, Vasanti? Even if you are considered the most sinful of sinners, when you're situated on the boat of transcendental knowledge, then you're able to cross beyond the ocean of all miseries. Not that you remain a sinner, even if you have been the most sinful of sinners. When you're situated on the boat of transcendental knowledge, it means that you know I'm Krishna's servant, so I'm not going to be sinning anymore. And you know all the other stuff about the relationship of Krishna, this world, you, dasmul shiksha. Situated on the boat, not theoretically, but practically, then you'll be able to cross beyond the ocean of all miseries. What did I just say, Krishna Bhakti?
Once you're sitting on the boat of knowledge, you will be able to cross over the ocean of misery.
Even if what?
Even if you're the most sinful.
And what kind of knowledge?
Transcendental.
Good. As a blazing fire turns firewood to ashes, so does the fire of perfect knowledge burn to ashes all the reactions of material existence. Did you get that? Just as a blazing fire turns firewood to ashes, right? There's firewood. And there's a blazing fire. And by that blazing fire, all that wood turns into ashes, right? Similarly, the fire of perfect knowledge, realized knowledge, turns to ashes all the reactions of sinful activities. Like, all we know now are the reactions to our sinful activities. That's our reality. Isn't that weird? So therefore, we need to be burnt up. I mean, our sinful reactions need to be burnt up in the fire of what, Narada? Huh? Perfect what? Knowledge. Good. In fact, in this world, there's nothing so pure and sublime as transcendental knowledge. Such knowledge is the mature fruit of all mysticism. And one who has achieved this knowledge, he enjoys himself within due course of time. And such a person attains supreme peace. But then there are those who doubt the revealed scriptures and do not attain God consciousness. For the doubting soul, there is no happiness either in this life or in the next. What did I just say, Narada? Trouble hearing? Here, sit here. Things get muffled in the back there. You could sit here because you're a good student. Thus ends chapter 4. Now we're entering chapter 5. Again, Arjuna is confused. O Krishna, first of all, you ask me to renounce work. And then again, you recommend work with devotion. So can you kindly tell me definitely which is better, which is more beneficial? So Krishna replies, work and renunciation, the renunciation of work and work in devotion, they're both good to liberation. But of the two, work and devotion is superior. Why? He's going to explain why. One who neither hates nor desires the fruits of his activities is known to be truly renounced. In other words, one who just renounces the activity, he's not renounced. But one who renounces, who neither hates nor desires the fruits of his activities, he's understood to be renounced, and he works in devotion. Such a person, liberated from all dualities, easily overcomes bondage and is completely liberated. One who knows that the position reached by means of renunciation can also be obtained by works in devotion, and who therefore sees that the path of work and the path of renunciation is one, sees things as they are. That's why Krishna can say, I'm not the doer, being unchangeable. Follow, he's explaining throughout all this. I'm renounced from all activities. One who sees action in inaction and inaction in action is understood to be a knower. Otherwise, unless one is engaged in devotional service, mere renunciation of activities cannot make one happy. A person with divine consciousness, even if he's engaged in seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, eating, moving about, breathing, always knows that he's not doing anything at all. That's why Krishna could say, although I'm the creator of the four divisions of work, I'm the non-doer, being unchangeable. And a person with divine consciousness is the same. No matter what he's doing, he knows that he's doing nothing at all. We can try and think that way, but we can't actually imitate that consciousness. It comes when it descends by mercy of Guru. Because while speaking, evacuating, receiving, opening and closing his eyes, He always knows that it's only the material senses interacting with their objects, and he's really aloof from them. It's a good meditation. How about if we all try that tomorrow and then come back and tell our experience in tomorrow's class? Does that sound good? Homework? The steadily devoted soul attains unadulterated peace because he offers the results of all of his activities to me. Whereas a person who's not in union with the divine, who is greedy for the fruits of his labor, he becomes entangled. Very deep thoughts. One who actually follows my instructions, he lives very happily within the city of nine gates. The eyes are gates. They lead out to the city of sight. And the sense of hearing is a gate. The ears are a gate. They lead out to the senses of hearing. But really, we're not anywhere. We're just in our own misconception. We're always alone. We think that we're with others, but we're only really in our own conceptions. It's our sensual perceptions, our interaction of the senses with the sense objects. Now, the embodied spirit, master of the city of nine gates, he doesn't create activities, nor does he induce others to act, nor does he create the fruits of action. All this is enacted by the modes of nature. Nor does the Supreme Spirit assume anyone's sinful or pious activities. In other words, don't blame Krishna for anything. Embodied beings, however, are bewildered because of the ignorance which veils his real knowledge. What's the cause? The embodied beings are bewildered by the ignorance that veils his real knowledge. Not the Supreme Spirit doesn't assume responsibility for pious or impious activities, but rather, the embodied beings are bewildered by the ignorance that covers his real knowledge. Ignorance, avidya, means turning away from Krishna. When, however, one is enlightened by the knowledge by which nescience is destroyed, when one is enlightened by the knowledge, with the knowledge, by which nescience is destroyed, then his knowledge reveals everything, just as the sun reveals everything in the daytime. Do you know all these from Badger? Some? And if we can just be established in sameness and equanimity that Krishna is talking about, those whose minds are established in sameness and equanimity have already conquered over the conditions of birth and death. So we can tell how many births and deaths are going to be taken by how well established we are in sameness and equanimity. They are flawless like Brahman, thus they are already situated in Brahman. He doesn't rejoice when he gets something pleasant. He doesn't lament when he gets something unpleasant. He's self-intelligent, unbewildered, and he knows the science of God. Such a person is understood to be situated in transcendence. Because Arjuna asked, remember back in the second chapter, how can I tell a person who's situated in transcendence? How does he sit? How does he walk? What's his language? Okay, now we're finished with chapter 5 and we're going to chapter 6. Krishna says, it's still more or less along the same line. One who is unattached to the fruits of his work, but who works as he is obligated, he's in the renounced order. And he's a true mystic, not he who lights no fire nor performs no work. What does that mean, lights no fire nor performs no work? It means that the real sannyasi is the one who works for Krishna, not who is like a Maya body and thinks that everything is Maya, including Krishna's work, so I'm not going to do anything. Just by his breathing, he's suffering. And he has to do something. No one can be free from activity. Anybody who's in a body has to work. Number one, because the modes of nature are always make one work. And secondly, the soul is always active. So if I'm not active for Krishna, I have to be active for Maya. What is called renunciation is the same as yoga, or linking oneself with the Supreme, Narottam. Because nobody can be a perfect yogi unless he's renounced the desire for sense gratification. A man, don't blame anybody, because a man must elevate himself by his own mind and not degrade himself. The mind is the best friend of the conditioned soul. You know, ever since you did that to me, it made me feel like this. That is such Maya. Because Krishna says a man must elevate himself by his own mind and not degrade himself. He has to take responsibility for his own feelings. No one can make anyone feel anything. My responsibility, how I feel. It's not my responsibility what you do, but it's my responsibility how I respond to it. A man must elevate himself by his own mind and not degrade himself. That's our duty. The mind is the best friend of the conditioned soul and his greatest enemy as well. For one who has conquered the mind is the best friend. And for one who has failed to do so, Radharaman, did you hear that? Radharaman, could you repeat that? For one who has conquered the mind is the best of friends. And for one who has failed to do so, that very mind is the greatest enemy. For one whose mind is conquered, super soul is already reached and he has attained tranquility. To such a man, happiness and distress, heat and cold, honor and dishonor are all the same. A person is said to be established in self-realization and is called a yogi or a mystic when he is fully satisfied by virtue of acquired knowledge and realization. Such a person is situated in transcendence and is self-controlled. He sees everything, whether it be a pebble, stone, or gold. Just like Vasanti, she has monkey stool right outside her room and she's transcendental to it. She doesn't bother me at all. She sees gold or monkey stool or pebbles as the same. And then one is even more advanced if he considers the honest well-wisher, the friend, the enemy, the indifferent, the envious, the pious, the sinner, and those who are impartial with an equal mind. If somebody hates me or somebody likes me, I see them both equally. That's my responsibility. This person who hates me really aggravates me, and this person who loves me really makes me feel good. And then Krishna talks about how the yogi is. He goes to the secluded place and he stares steadily at the tip of the nose and he sits very straight. He sits on kusha grass and a deer skin or a soft cloth. And his eyes are half closed. Body, neck, and head erect. Meditating on me, there's no possibility of becoming a yogi or Arjuna. If one sleeps too much or too little, eats too much or does not eat enough, that's what I always tell Vasanti when she brings me Too little, I say, you know, one cannot become a yogi if he does not eat enough. One who is temperate in his habits of eating, sleeping, working, and recreation can mitigate all material pangs by practice of yoga. That means you can't be too much of a workaholic. You have to have some spiritual recreation. Otherwise, you can't be a yogi. And you can't have too much recreation. You have to do enough service. Just as a lamp in a windless place does not waver, so a transcendentalist whose mind is in control does not waver, but he's steady in his meditation on the transcendent self, Krishna. Narottam, are you like a lamp in a windless place who does not waver? Now we come to the very big verse. That's a combination of verse 20 to 23. This stage of perfection, Narottam, if you could do this, if you could be like a lamp in a windless place that does not waver, then you know what's going to happen? This stage of perfection is called trance or samadhi. When one's mind is completely refrained or restrained from material mental activities, and by the practice of yoga, and the mind finds satisfaction in the self alone. This is characterized by one's ability to see the self with a pure mind and to relish and rejoice in the self. In this joyous state, one experiences boundless transcendental happiness. He enjoys himself not by the externals, but he enjoys himself through transcendental senses. His senses are purified. He takes pleasure within. Established thus, once you get there, established thus, he never departs from the truth, and he's not deviated even in the midst of the greatest difficulty. This indeed is actual freedom from the miseries arising from material contact. One should engage himself in the practice of yoga with undeviating determination and faith. One should abandon without exception all material desires born of false ego, and should thus control all senses on all sides by the mind. Then he explains how the yogi who is absorbed in me, he attains the highest happiness. For one who sees me everywhere and who sees everything in me, I'm never lost, nor is he ever lost to me. Yeah, and plus, for relating to everybody else, he is a perfect yogi who, in comparison to his own self, sees the true equality of all beings, both in their happiness and distress. Very, very important. And people write whole books just coming from this verse, relating to others, on the basis of humanity. Not that somebody is different from me or somebody has different values than me, but seeing both in their happiness and distress, he sees that everyone is equal. Everybody has the same problems, the same sensitivities, the same fears, the same scared of the same kind of thing. Except different people have different varieties. So Gurudev is explaining that proper communication is to hear the happiness and distress in others, and then together come to some conclusion about what to do. So he's a perfect yogi who, in comparison, by comparison to his own self, he sees the true equality in all beings, both in their happiness and distress. Plus, he knows that everybody's beyond it. Like for material communication, he sees that on the material platform. And above and beyond that, he sees that everyone is beyond all their ups and downs, sensitivities, fears, things that get them angry. things that want to make them kill somebody. That Arjuna has an objection again. He says, but Krishna, this system of yoga which you're explaining to me, which you summarized, appears very impractical and unendurable to me. For the mind is restless and unsteady. The mind is restless, turbulent, obstinate, and very strong, O Krishna. And to subdue it seems to me more difficult than to control the wind. That's not Krishna Balabha, is it?
Oh, wow.
Hari Bol, welcome. So Arjuna is saying, control the mind is more difficult than to control the wind. So Krishna replies, Almighty Son of Kunti, undoubtedly, I agree with you. It's undoubtedly very difficult to control the mind. But it's possible. In fact, Arjuna was saying, it's just about easier to control the wind that's coming, which is not possible, than to control the mind. So Krishna said, it's undoubtedly difficult to curb the restless mind, but it is practical, it is possible by constant practice and detachment. Detachment means you don't just get fed up if it doesn't work. For the mind that's uncontrolled and unbridled, self-realization is difficult. But for one whose mind is controlled and he strives by right means, he's assured of success. This is, Krishna says, this is my opinion. And then Arjuna asks another question, which gets Krishna off onto another train of thought. What's the destination of a man of faith who does not persevere, who in the beginning takes to the process of yoga or self-realization, but then he desists due to worldly mindedness, like he bloops? And he does not attain perfection in this life. Does he, being deviated from the path of transcendence, does he just perish like a ribbon cloud, like a cloud that's just scattered into pieces and goes off into nowhere, with no position in any sphere? Is that what happens to him? This is my doubt, O Krishna, and I ask you to dispel it completely. But for you, no one can destroy my doubt. So Krishna replied, a transcendentalist who is engaged in auspicious activities does not meet with destruction either in this life or in the next, or in the spiritual world. For one who does good, my friend, he's never, what? Overcome by evil. If you do good, you'll never have evil come to you. The unsuccessful yogi, after many, many years of enjoyment in the heavenly planets, of the pious living entities, he's born into a family of righteous people or into a family of rich aristocracy where he gets an opportunity to again take up spiritual life. Or if he's more fortunate, then he takes birth in a family of transcendentalists, and that birth is very rare. Such transcendentalists are fixed in wisdom, so he very easily gets the opportunity to continue his service from his last life. On taking such a birth, he revives his divine consciousness from his previous birth, and thus he makes further progress on the path. He automatically becomes attracted to spiritual activity. The yogi is greater than the ascetic, greater than the empiricist, greater than the fruitive worker. So in all circumstances, Arjuna, be a yogi. What is yogi? What is called yoga, what is called renunciation is the same as yoga. For no one can be a perfect yogi unless he renounces the desire for sense gratification. And you can only do that when the senses are regulated in devotional service. And of all yogis, one who abides in me with great faith, worshipping me in transcendental loving service, he's the most intimately united with me in yoga, and he's the highest of all. So, Janava, who's the highest yogi? Louder? And what else? How is he united? By transcendental loving service. And with great faith. And he's also the highest of all. Now we've finished chapter 6. As though we finished it. We started chapter 6. And now we're going to chapter 7. Krishna says, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha Maya Shabda Mana Parta Yogam Janja Parashaya Asamsayam Samagrama Yata Gyasasitachanu. Now hear, O Parta, how by practicing yoga in full consciousness of me, with mind attached to me, you can know me in truth or in full, free from doubt. Now he's going to tell us. Now I shall declare to you that knowledge, both phenomenal and numinous, or material and spiritual, knowing which there's nothing remaining to be known. Out of many, many thousands among men, one may endeavor for perfection. Out of thousands of men who endeavor for perfection, hardly one knows me in truth. And now I'm going to tell you some material secrets mixed with spiritual. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. And Vasanti is going to give us a presentation on false ego tomorrow. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. These eight comprise my separated material energy. Besides the inferior nature, Arjuna, there's a superior energy of mind which comprises all living entities who are struggling with material nature, but at the same time sustaining the universe. Because if there were no souls in the universe, all the matter would just like dribble into nowhere. It's like when the soul leaves this body, it just turns to dust. Dost thou work, dost thou beast. Beyond that, of all that is spiritual and all that is material in the world, you should know that I am its origin and its dissolution. Everything comes out of me and goes into me. In fact, there is just no truth superior to me. Everything rests in me, as Peralta hung on the thread. Matat parataram nanyat kinshit asti dananjaya mai sarvam idam proktam sutre manigana iva. Plus, if you want some specifics, then, O son of Kunti, I am the taste of water, the light of the sun and the moon. What does that mean? That if you just look at the sun, then that's your God worship? No. It means that you see it as Krishna's energy coming from him, and it doesn't exist independently of him. I am the light of the... So by remembering all these things as we're looking about, we can be Shastra Chaksus, seeing through the eyes of scripture, or Jnana Chaksus, seeing through the eyes of knowledge. So some specifics now Krishna is giving us. I am the taste of the water. There's different ways you can recognize me or remember me. The light of the sun and the moon. The syllable Om and the Vedic mantras. On the sound in the ether. Came from Krishna, lives in Krishna. is Krishna's energy, and I'm the ability in man. That way you never get envious of anybody, because you know it's just Krishna. I'm the original fragrance of the earth, the heat and the fire, the life of all that lives, and I'm the penance of all ascetics. I'm the original seed of all existence, the intelligence of the intelligent, and the prowess of all powerful men. I'm the strength of the strong, devoid of passion and desire. I'm sex life which is not contrary to religious principles. All states of being. I mean, never mind all these details. Let's just summarize it by saying all states of being, whether in goodness, passion, and ignorance, they're all manifested by my energy. In one sense, I'm everything, but at the same time, I'm independent. Nothing else is independent, but I'm independent. I'm not under the modes of nature. But everybody else is. In fact, deluded by the modes of nature, the whole world does not know me, who am above the modes and inexhaustible. Now we come to another very famous verse. Daiviyesha gunamai mama maya jarachaya mameva ye bhavadyaste mayame tam tarantite. This divine energy of mine, consisting of the three modes of nature, is very difficult to overcome. In other words, maya is very difficult to overcome. But one who surrenders to me can easily cross beyond it. But some people, those who are miscreants, grossly foolish, lowest of the mankind, and those whose knowledge is stolen away by illusion, they partake of the atheistic nature of the demons. They don't surrender to me. Then there are four kinds of pious people who do devotional service to me. The distressed, the desire of wealth, the inquisitive, and he who is searching for knowledge of the Absolute. Of these, the one who is actually in full knowledge, who is in union with me through pure devotional service, he's the best. Not the one who's coming for money, or he's distressed, or he's just inquisitive, but one who's in knowledge, in full knowledge in union with me. All these devotees are undoubtedly magnanimous souls, and I consider that they dwell in me. Being engaged in my transcendental service, they attain me. After many, many births and deaths, one who is actually in knowledge, who knows that there's nothing existing outside of me, who knows that I'm all in all, that I'm the cause of all causes and all in all, such a great soul is very rare. Bhavanam janmanam ante jnanavama prabhajate vasudeve sarvamiti samahatma sudurlabha. That's 719. Very famous verse. Well, does anybody have any questions? That was a lot, Krishna said. And if somebody doesn't want to worship Krishna, but they want to worship the demigods, then what? Krishna says, I'm in everyone's heart as a super soul. And as soon as someone desires to worship a demigod, I'm the one that makes his face steady so that he can worship that particular deity. He can't escape Krishna. So endowed with such a faith, the person worships that demigod, but even the results that he gets from the demigods are actually coming from me. Do you understand English? Is he translating for you? So the question is, why does Krishna make the faith of one who worships the demigod steady? Krishna doesn't interfere with our independence, but he wants to show us that if we don't follow his instructions, but we act out of false consciousness, then we're lost. So he lets us get a little lost, just to show us that this is what happens. I'm giving you knowledge, and if you don't want to hear it, if you want to be independent, go ahead and I'll give you all facility, but then you'll suffer and then you'll come to me. You know, if I say, Krishna Bhakti, you have to come to my class. Don't go to Padmanabh Maharaj's class. He doesn't give such a good class. Come to my class, you have to. In fact, I'm not giving you any choice in the matter. What if I say that, what will you do? You won't want to come. Because I'm trying to take away your independence. I'm trying to control you. So Krishna, although he does control everything, at the same time he gives us our independence. But nothing can happen without him. So we can only have steady faith if he gives it to us. Because he says, I am situated in everyone's heart as super soul. From me comes remembrance, knowledge, forgetfulness, no getting around it. Later on in the ninth chapter, he'll say that one who worships the demigods is actually worshiping me without proper understanding. Because there's nothing in existence except for me. Any other questions? Unintelligent men who know me not think that I've assumed this form and personality. They think my body is material. Due to small knowledge, they do not know my transcendental nature, which is changeless and supreme. Even Krishna gets criticized, so what if we do? Big deal. And I'm never manifest to the foolish and unintelligent anyway. For them, I'm always covered by my creative potency, Yoga Maya. And thus the deluded world knows me not, who am transcendental and inexhaustible. Now he's going to tell, with that consideration, why people are born in this world. O conqueror of the foe, all living entities are born into delusion, meaning this material world, overcome by the dualities of desire and hate. In other words, we desire to be Krishna and we hate the fact that Krishna is Krishna. And that's it. And my eyes are running out and my throat is running out. So, do you have any questions or anybody want to say something? Or recite some verses? Hare Krishna. Swagatam. See, if we had a book table, we could have just given the books on their way out. We have to get that Elmira. I see 4.5 strong men here.
You get the workers to do it. The Elmira is never going to open.
It's never going to open?
No, it's only storage.
It's only storage? So what is your plan?
All the books are in the chair.
Yeah, but nobody can see them.
But when there's